Dr. Hatem Beyz, he currently teaches at UC Berkeley, where he graduated a PhD in Islamic Studies, specializing in Islamic law and the history of Muslim in Jerusalem. He is the director of the Al-Halam Institute at Islamic Sciences, Berkeley. Dr. Beyz has also authored numerous articles on various aspects of the Middle East and is frequently called upon by the Bay Area national media to comment on Middle East issues, and we're calling on him this morning. Good morning, Dr. Beyz.
Good morning, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm fine. Happy to have you on the air again. Today,
it's always a pleasure.
Today, Israel and supporters around the world are celebrating the 50th anniversary of its declaration of statehood, an event that for Palestinians is known as a Nakba, the catastrophe. It seems clear this catastrophe has never ended, and in fact, it has gotten worse. Could you comment on that?
Well, the Nakba has not stopped in the sense that the dispossession of the Palestinians started earlier than that, even by the beginning of the Balfour Declaration and the whole campaign to transform Palestine into a state for European Jewry, in particular under the auspices of the World Zionist Organization. And it's from that date up to the present, the process is still unfolding, through which Palestinians are being dispossessed of their own land and treated as pariah, both in their own indigenous land as well as across the world, for no other reason than objecting to be distant homes. So this is at least the Nakba has not stopped for the Palestinians.
Well, one of the things that has been very critical is the use of language, or what I should call the abuse of language, in terms of even today or over the years, the land taken in 1967, which is illegal under international, is never described as such in the newspapers unless it is referred to as Palestinians claiming that it is, and that law language has become very important as so-called disputed territories. Israel is now planning a unilateral redefining, or actually defining, because they never defined what Israel's borders were under Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Perhaps you could comment on that.
Well, language is very important and critical. It's the process of erasing the other begins with language, begins with using different descriptions and different terminology. So, for example, in many places, you'll find the reference to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria. Thus, the cities, the names of the cities that are there are not mentioned whatsoever, which is essentially try to sort of superimpose a particular narrative, the narrative that affirms Zionist narrative relative to Palestine, in particular to, at this point, the 1967 areas, and erase the Palestinian narrative. So much so that you could actually see some writings and some references where actually the Palestinians are described as occupying the ancestral historical homeland for the Zionists. And this is where you to shake your head and scratch it. But this is the type of terminology that are there. There is no more, still, in Israel itself, the Palestinian territories are considered to be disputed territories. Disputed by who? By those who are occupying it. And in here in the U.S., whatever the Israeli official position is, it's parroted here in the media and parroted across many arenas, including the political arena, which is exactly is just a soundboard, stenographs for Israeli positions and statements. So I'm not surprised with this continued, at least, silencing of Palestinian narrative, silencing of Palestinian history, silencing of Palestinian geography, silencing of every element of Palestine. And it's an ongoing struggle just to actually redefine the terms that we use, in particular, that there is such thing as an occupation. There is such thing as an occupier. There is such a reference to a set of international laws and international principles that govern the occupied territories and the manner by which an occupied power deals with its occupied population. but none of this is applicable, and it seems that we're living in some different warp time relative to the Palestine-Israel conflict.
Well, it's certainly interesting in terms of again, the language. Even the term occupation ordinarily would refer to a static situation in which another country sends its army into an area, but what Israel has done under that occupation is a continued dispossession.
It's a permanent occupation. It's an occupation to facilitate conquest and facilitate expansion. The West Bank is dotted with all kinds of settlements. Almost 40% plus of it is taken up by these settlements, which right now houses over 400,000 settlers, and these are under international law, under any set of international standards, are illegal, and they have no legitimacy. But once again, they are seen as the legitimate, and the Palestinians are in normal processes of expansion and development of these settlements. And in many places in our press, you rarely find the term settlement is used. It's neighborhoods or Jewish communities in the West Bank. So even of not calling a settlement for what it is, an illegal settlement, you never actually see the adjective illegal with the description if it's described in the media or the press or any of these statements of actually having the adjective illegal attached to it. Rather, if it's I'm happy if they use the term settlement. Most often they use neighborhoods, especially when they say, let's say, Gilo neighborhood next to Jerusalem. All these areas are occupied, and settlement activities are being undertaken, dispossessing once again Palestinians and pushing them out to live on their own accord by making life hellish for them, and as such, slow and quiet ethnic cleansing can occur without saying that you are actually responsible for it. It's just they are choosing to leave to pursue better opportunities, while the so-called multilateral negotiations on refugees and on Palestinian refugees issue can facilitate immigration for the Palestinians. So, in a sense, there's a cooperative effort between the so-called multilateral parties that are engaged, including some of the Western countries, Australia, Canada, and so on, which essentially they are cooperating on the process of dispossession of the Palestinians under the guise of helping so-called peace process.
Actually, the word illegal is used occasionally, but it's very Orwellian. It's when the Israelis refer to what they call illegal outposts. So these illegal outposts, which are usually some caravans or some trailers, mm-hmm. are supposed to be the ones that can be removed. There's hardly anybody there, which in a sense makes the reader believe that the rest of the settlements are legitimate. And so obviously this, in the American media, unlike the European media, this isn't even questioned anymore.
Sure.
And of course we have the apartheid wall, which is three times higher than the Berlin Wall, which is determined illegal by international court. It meant nothing.
Well, the United States and Israel are the two major players that just really give their back to the International Court of Justice. And once again, I'm not surprised, since Israel is being dealt with as an exception to the rule. It does not adhere to any set of international standards, and it sees that as long as the U.S. Continues to support its effort and continues to give it diplomatic cover, continues to give it economic aid as well as military aid, and have linked itself to the so-called U.S. war on terrorism, whatever Israel does, it's rationalized and supported. And now we have in the halls of the United Nations none other than Bolton, who possibly would be even considered to be extreme right wing in Israel, become more extreme than Sharon himself, and he's not going to raise any finger to try to bring any type of international censure or any type of international discussions of Israel's position, and this has been the case for the U.S. for quite some time.
Well, it's interesting. We're always told that Israel is a client state of the United States, but there's some questions which is a client state. I recall back during the Carter administration, the U.S. was not allowed. It was not allowed for any U.S. official to speak with a member of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. Now, where did this restriction come from? It was demanded by Israel and enforced by the pro-Israel lobby here in the United States. And Andrew Young, who was President Carter's U.N. ambassador, had a secret meeting with PLO, revealed that he had to resign his position. Today, we see the same thing with Hamas. The U.S. is not allowed to speak with an official of Hamas. It's amazing that a country, the most mightiest superpower of the world, is prohibited from talking to a representative, a legally elected representative of another people. And this comes not as a demand. This is a demand from both Israel and by the pro-Israel lobby here, which shows the kind of clout that they have over U.S. policy.
Well, the process of reflecting Israeli desires and Israeli wishes in the political arena in the U.S. is really very disheartening, and it also brings the whole issue of the lobby and the success of the lobby in the U.S. I think AIPAC has been able to be very successful in its effort to mobilize the energies of the the organized American Jewish community to the defense of Israel and promoting of Israel interests, and making Israel interests appear to be U.S. interests, and sometimes even superseding U.S. interests in general. As such, you are correct in pointing out that during the 70s and 80s, the Israeli position that was forwarded to the U.S., then not to talk or negotiate with the PLO until the PLO fulfills Israel's preset conditions on it. And now we're seeing the ball being played again with the incoming Palestinian government led by Hamas, and they're being asked to fulfill the conditions that Israel has been placed on them, even though that Israel itself no longer is adhering to these demands that they're asking the Palestinians to fulfill. They're asking the new government to accept Oslo. Well, the Israelis themselves distanced themselves from Oslo. Netanyahu campaigned on letting go of Oslo. Even Olmert said Oslo is dead, and that's why we're going through unilateral separation, quote-unquote, or the unilateral action. Also, they want them to recognize the roadmap to peace. Once again, the Israeli political spectrum across the spectrum have turned away from roadmap to peace, and Olmert himself has said that we're no longer adhering to the roadmap to peace. And Sharon, before his stroke, likewise said that it's a dead plan. So they're asking the new Palestinian government to accept something that Israel itself has rejected and turned away from, and they're asking the Palestinians to accept the peace process, where no peace process has been unfolding for quite some time. If the peace process was so successful, why was Yasser Arafat penned up in his two-room headquarters for 2 years under the direction of Israeli guns surrounding him? And if the peace process is so great, why you had Mahmoud Abbas, who was ready to jump all the hoops to sign whatever is placed in front of him, and he's still ready and committed to try to negotiate and put something on the table. So I think, once again, Israel wants to have the notion that there is no partner for peace, but they don't say that they are the absent partner, not the Palestinians. But through saying that there is no partner for peace, therefore we could continue doing and taking steps, which is business as usual, continue to expand settlements, confiscate land, build bypass roads, to formulate the plan that they already had in mind, which is to prevent a viable Palestinian state from emerging, to prevent the Palestinians controlling their own borders, prevent the Palestinians from controlling any resemblance of an economy, and essentially blame the Palestinians for their circumstances, and pointing out that the reason this is happening is because, quote-unquote, you have elected a terrorist government, and if the current government was terrorist, what about last year? Was the Palestinian Authority under Abbas and Fatah was not a terrorist government? So this brings this whole notion that Israel is intending on securing as biggest amount or a biggest swath of land in the West Bank as possible, and then to allow the Palestinians greater or expanded autonomy under some guise of a independent state that is emptied of any notions of independent. It will have no control of its water resources, and the water resources will be already are taken by means of the wall. The wall followed a particular type of footprint in the West Bank to maximize Israeli control of water, and therefore the Palestinians are going to get up and realize that they might have an expanded autonomous state that is emptied of water resources. It has no ability to move its commodities, its products, agricultural products. Most of its agricultural land will be at the stranglehold of the Israeli settlements inside the West Bank and at the Makrut Water Company, which will be selling each drop to the Palestinians. And then they will not be able to enter and exit these territories except with the permission of the Israelis. So this is what Sharon has all along wanted. And now, actually, with this current dynamics, it might come to pass, while at the same time we're blaming the Palestinians again for the fact that Israel wants to be an expansionist state.
No, it's interesting. Sharon has been hailed in the West as his, before he be sunk into his coma, as this great hero for sacrificing, land that Israel had occupied in Gaza with his so-called disengagement, whereas those with more of an insight saw it was simply a different form of control. And obviously, the situation in Gaza has worsened. The Israelis were not directly in the towns of Gaza before, and now with this, they've made this huge buffer zone. They've been shelling Gaza regularly and starving the people there.
Yeah, well, Gaza is just a large prison, so it's thinking of St. Quentin, just expanded and enlarged to a greater extent, where all the Palestinians in there, about 1.2 million, are really locked up in this huge prison called the Gaza Strip, with two major exit and entrance, two major entrances and exits, one on the Egypt side and one on Israel side. And basically the Israelis are having a field day. Daily they are being shelled. About 200 rockets are being fired by the Israelis to the Palestinians. And it's always being reported, when you see, this is the sickening of the reports that you see on a daily basis, that they are targeting suspected missile launching pads. And when you see this, meaning once again Israel is only retaliating. This is just an enormous obfuscation that takes place, where it's really is not a retaliation, it's a deliberate attack that takes place on a daily basis against civilian population in the Gaza Strip, and it's spring itself. It's really a sickening process of continued shelling of Palestinian areas in the Gaza Strip. These are refugees that have shackles, shacks as houses made of tin, and roofs that are barely could keep the water out, and you see shellings that are taking place with rockets that are more for directed for military type of engagements, and this is going on a daily basis. And again, Israel can go to the international community that we're protecting ourselves, and Hamas is and the Palestinian government is not recognizing us. And the question is to recognize what, and what framework about. And this is what needs to be really brought to the front. If you're asking the Palestinians to recognize Israel, why don't we ask the Israelis first to recognize the Palestinian sovereignty of a state based on Resolution 181 if you want the two-state solution? But the victim is being asked to recognize the right of his victimizer to actually continue victimizing him before so-called the international community or those who are looking at issues of justice can come and step him over and then bring him back for you to beat him up again. This is, seems to be the role of the international community at this point.
Well, one thing that I had pointed out in an article I wrote about the reason Israel wanted the U.S. to go into Iraq and was that the U.S. would become an occupier of Arab land just like Israel, and then would have to not only get some guidance from the Israeli that doesn't want to be occupied, but also that it would then make the United States less willing or less able to criticize Israel's treatment of the Palestinians when the U.S. soldiers were doing the very same thing to the Iraqis, and that seems to have come to pass.
I think the Israelis did offer and provided their know-how of how to occupy and how to manage occupation, especially during the Jenin operation. We know that there were U.S. Military personnel that were brought in with the Israelis to monitor or to see how it's being conducted. But actually, in the building up to the Iraq War and immediately thereafter, I did actually give a complete talk and wrote about it. That I said if the Iraq operation succeeds, I would say that Israel will definitely be a recipient of the largesse of the success. But if it fails, my sense then and still my sense today that the biggest consequences and the biggest loser for this would be Israel itself in the U.S. And my thinking is the following, that prior to this Iraq campaign, the Palestine-Israel conflict was contained to the interests of the Jewish community, the organized Jewish community in the U.S., and possibly the Palestinian/Arab community and their supporters. As such, the influence that was brought to bear by AIPAC succeeded without any impediment whatsoever. But as far as the Iraq operation with the U.S. troops being there, if it fails, and we see that it is failing, that the issue of the Middle East and the issue of Palestine, Israel, and Iraq and so on becomes the daily talk of Americans everywhere, in every donut shop and a coffee shop, the discussion will come back to what are we doing in the Middle East, what are our policy, and this would result in opening all questions, and paramount among those questions is the Israeli-American alliance and whether that's in the best interest of the U.S. or not. And I think we are seeing this ripple effect coming. It began even right at the onset of the Iraq War when Anthony Zinni says this is the Iraq War was for Israel and this is the worst. The worst-kept secret in Washington, and he was accused of, once again, of the whole accusation of anti-Semitism. And recently we've seen the paper written by Mersheimer and Walt on the issue of AIPAC and its power and its influence in U.S. Foreign policy. And I think this is a direct result of the failure in Iraq, not as a result of the specificity of the Israel-Palestine issue. That the realization within the U.S. administration that their entanglement in Iraq right now is opening up the whole discussion of the overall foreign policy scope of the U.S. to the totality of the Middle East, and Israel right now is featured center stage. Now, definitely you have some elements that are going to try to have exclusivity scapegoating Israel as their only reason, and I think that also becomes problematic, and I'm not the one that just says the U.S. is the imperialist power, but also we don't want to fall into that it was only Israel by itself that is undertaking this, but rather there are some U.S. interests as well that has to be articulated. But I think currently all these issues are on the table, and the discussion has started as a result of the failure in Iraq, because I think it was not in the best interest, even if you want to look at it from a rationalist realist approach of U.S. foreign policy objectives, that this was not in the national, in the U.S. national interest. Only some segment within the U.S. pushed for it, and this segment was decisively allied with the Likudist aspect of the Israeli political landscape.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned all that, because the Mearsheimer Walt paper, for listeners who aren't familiar with it, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago and Stephen Walt, academic dean of the Kennedy Center at Harvard, in March, put out a paper called On the Israel Lobby, Detriment to U.S. Foreign Policy, which they could not get published in the United States. It was published in the London Review of Books, and is a shorter version, 23 pages, and is available online. And these two mainstream academicians,
conservative academicians,
and they broke a taboo, and which has gotten, of course, them called anti-Semites and neo-Nazis, and they've identified with the worst racists in America. But the fact is, their paper has opened a new discussion, because they said this war in Iraq was for not in the U.S. interest, as Hatem mentioned. And in fact, President George Bush's father, Senior Bush, his Secretary of State James Baker, his National Security Council advisor Brent Scowcroft, as well as General Schwarzkopf, were opposed to this war, as were the oil companies, because oil companies need stability, not the kind of chaos this war has produced.
And that's the aspect, that you have a traditional realist camp within the U.S. foreign policy establishment, and they were all against this Iraq venture, from their perspective, that we have been able to actually manipulate and have some elements of control of the oil in the Middle East through indirect means, without having to have actually physical military presence on the ground in terms of occupation or physically controlling the oil fields. So these elements that have called for the Iraq war are from the radical right, or what came to be known as the neoconservatives. And there is a split among the large camp of conservatives in the U.S. between those who are called the neoconservatives and those who are traditional conservatives. And one aspect of the neoconservatives is their decisive articulation of a defense of Israel position, which initially was written for Prime Minister Netanyahu, and it became center stage by 1998. Early in the Clinton, and then after September 11th, became the adopted policy. And I think we're seeing once again the reflection of this split coming into the fruition as a result of the failure. The failure in Iraq, in my perspective, will reopen many elements of U.S. foreign policy in more ways than what would have been possible in the pre-Iraq campaign. I think this what we need to realize. The Mearsheimer report would not have been written. I don't think there would have been any critique had the Iraq operation was not undertaken, and had the operation succeeded. It has it been a cakewalk like what Cheney wanted, but obviously anyone with some grade level education in military campaigns would understand that cakewalks are very few and rare to come by, and as such, this is the consequences of this, is the opening up of all these issues, and I think we are looking in the near future, possibly, in an expanded discussion of this particular aspect, which is the Israeli-American alliance, whether it's real, whether it does serve American interests, and whether the U.S. can alter its approach to dealing with the Arab and Muslim world, in particular relative to the Palestine-Israel conflict. My sense is that the U.S. will alter and change direction as it's looking for an interlocutor across the Arab and Muslim world to disentangle itself from the specific consequences in Iraq, as well as the larger political arena in the Arab and Muslim world. And as we see, part of this is how to link to the Muslim world through some level of political engagement with those who might be ready to help you as interest in such a way, while at the same time maintaining some level of domestic legitimacy. I have a whole critique of that, but this is where the U.S. is going, and I think it's working on a dialogue across many parts of the Muslim world, including with a wide swath of the Islamic forces in the Muslim world. There was the dialogue taking place in Qatar. There's discussions with the members of the Muslim Brotherhood movement in Egypt. The movement in Morocco, I think it's Dawah. So there's many of these efforts that are being undertaken, which lead to the U.S. seeking close relations. And one of the impediments in those relations is the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Well, Hatem, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today and enlightening our audience on the situation in occupied Palestine and the struggle for justice there. Look forward to seeing you next time, and thanks for being our guest again on Takes on the World.
Thank you, Jeffrey.